Accession number 20782, Reel 1.
Mrs. Lipwick, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Warsaw.
Which year was this?
1930.
Did both your parents come from Warsaw?
My father did. My mother didn't. I'm not quite sure, but my mother was born near the Lithuanian border.
And what did your father do for a living?
My father was a doctor. He studied in Warsaw at university and later in Vienna, where he specialized in internal medicine, lungs, heart, and stomach.
So he worked in a hospital?
When he came back to Poland after being in Vienna, he worked in a hospital, which was in the Jewish area of Warsaw. I don't know exactly the name of the hospital, but only for a few years. And later on, he became a general practitioner. And he had his own surgery in the flat where we lived.
What was the address of that flat?
It was number 13, Zamenhofer Street. Named after the Zamenhof, I don't know whether you know, a doctor who, I think he also invented the Esperanto language at one time. And it was a very large building divided into courtyards. And there were three separate buildings, in other words. You went from one courtyard into the other. And our flat was on the second floor in the first courtyard. We had a surgery there and three extra rooms, family room and two bedrooms.
Whereabouts did you go to school?
I went to school in the same area. That's the sort of... Well, later it became the area of the ghetto, because that was the sort of Jewish area of Warsaw, really. And the school was mixed, and we don't, as you know probably, we didn't start school until we were 6 years old on the continent. It's still the same, I think. So I was, in 1936, started school. We had very long holidays, I can remember that, and we always went to either a forest area, mostly forest areas. There wasn't much sea other than the Baltic, and that was a long way, but there were a lot of lakes and forests, and my mother used to rent villas for about 2 months of the summer. And we had a nanny, because later on I had a sister as well. So for the first few years, my mother looked after me herself. But when my sister was born, there was a nanny, and there was also a domestic help, who both of those lived in. And she used to pack us off with with nanny with the help, and herself go with my father to some other spa or whatever it was, that for about 2 weeks, and we were left alone in that house in summer with the nanny. Now that went on sort of for about 3 years until 1939, the summer of 39. My uncle, who was my mother's brother, who was an officer on a very large Polish ship, which used to travel between Constancia, in those days it was called, it's Istanbul nowadays, and Haifa. He was working on the ship. In 39, in the spring, or was it just, yes, early spring, the ship was taken to Overall and in Constantia, and all the crew got a leave. And they came to Poland sometime in March or April. And he decided, because his wife had a father in Poland and she wanted to see her family, they decided to lease a hotel and run it for the summer holidays. And so myself and my parents, we were next door to the hotel, again in a villa, but we had all our meals in the hotel. And we spent there almost 2 months in the hotel. And that was a place called Brok nad Bugiem, which is the river Bug, which was running between Poland and Russia, that way somewhere. Toward the end of August, the trains were already being very, very active and requisitioned for the army, and it was very difficult to get back to Warsaw. And my father had to rent a car to come and collect us from the holiday to get back to Warsaw. By the 1st of September, as you know, it was the whole Poland was in an uproar, and he was called up within a couple of days because he was an officer in the reserve, and he got his uniform out. And he had to report to a hospital, which was given to him, and he had to make his own way. And that was not far from the Russian border. By the time he managed to get to this hospital, the hospital was evacuated, and he had to assign himself, as it were, to another hospital, which was nearer, because he couldn't get to that one anymore. Myself, my mother, my sister, who was 5 years, she was born in 37, she was 7 years younger than I was, and my grandfather, my mother's father, came to Warsaw with us after the holiday. We were both in our flat, and on the, what was it, I can't even remember the dates exactly, 1st or 3rd of September, well, there was terrible bombing before that, and Warsaw was being almost, straightened, not quite straightened to the ground, but it was terrific bombing, day and night, non-stop. And we spent more time in the shelter than in the flat. In fact, I think in the first week of the bombing, the house where we were, the block of flats, was hit, and half of our flat went down. So we were left with sort of half the flat on one side. A wall came completely down, and the surgery and the door was on the other side. We could just about go through, but it was dangerous. My grandfather was wounded at the time as well, because the shelter where he was, we weren't in the same one. He was in the front shelter, we were in the back shelter. It was covered up with bricks and mortar and all sorts of things. He had to be pulled out of there. And then my mother had, we got him back to the flat, and he had to rest for quite about 2 weeks nearly before he could walk again. The wounds weren't sort of drastic. It was just scraped from and overwhelmed by the fumes as well. And so we had no news at all about my father because all the communication was broken and we didn't know what happened. And then the Germans walked in to Warsaw. At the beginning, we didn't know what is going to be. It was a sort of very disorganized. But eventually, after about several weeks, we received a letter by a courier. It wasn't, post wasn't functioning. It was somebody who came from, you know, the other side of Poland and brought a letter from my father that he's in Białystok, which then was still in German hands at the beginning. Because later on, as you know, the Russians got part of Poland for appeasement, and for I don't know how long it lasted until the Germans attacked, you know, and took it all back again. So, in fact, at this time, he was in this hospital in Białystok, and we knew that this is going, there was already a talk about the Germans giving the Russians part of eastern Poland to keep them quiet, because they weren't ready for that front yet. And my mother immediately wrote a letter to him to try and get away the other way, not stay where he is, because that's not going to be very long under I'm not quite sure. I can't remember what year the agreement was signed between Germany and Russia, and that the Russians are getting those parts of eastern Poland.
Well, I think it was a secret agreement just before the German attack on Poland.
Yes, so whether the Russians walked in straight away at the same time into the eastern Poland and the Germans sort of stopped at that point. And when that letter came, he was already under the Russians in effect. And my mother, when she wrote back to him, she asked him to go and visit an aunt of ours, because she couldn't write exactly, you know, what she wanted him to do. But this aunt lived in Moscow somewhere. In other words, she gave him to understand that he should go east, away from the German border, and because it won't last for very long. We already felt the attitude, you know, that they were not going to stop with Poland, and that they've got ambitions of going much further than that. Well, he didn't take any notice, and until things started really very bad for us, because they started organizing Warsaw into the Jewish district, because there were a lot of Jewish families that lived in the other parts of Warsaw, which normally, you know, not many Jews lived in. And they started moving them out of their flats, the sort of very wealthy people, and getting them to live in the Jewish area, which was designated. So many sort of streets, and there was sort of started building a wall gradually around this area. And then very slowly, those that had no profession or were unemployed or whatever, were told that they're going to be sent to different places where they'll get work, and they could be productive rather than do nothing. Well, we didn't know anything about that, and quite a few people were, you know, volunteered who were without work and couldn't manage, and there's very few jobs going. But it didn't, you know, it didn't affect the professional ones, because they could still sort of make a kind of living. By the winter of 19, this is how it went to sort of end of 39. And in 1940, that's when it sort of started organizing the walls, and the walls were surrounding the whole area except for certain outlets where there was a break in the wall, and there was a patrol. Wehrmacht usually operated these gates, because there was still a little bit of freedom. You could get out by saying that you've got an appointment with a doctor on the other side, or you've got to see something, a dentist or whoever. And normally, if you had a card, that was another thing, a sort of like how do you call it, pass card or whatever it was, that they, with your name, your picture and so on, you were allowed to go for so many hours, providing you came back the same day. A lot of young children, I mean teenagers and so on, were going to the Polish side, as they call it, out of the ghetto, and doing some shopping and bringing food back and so on. In the meantime, in the ghetto itself, there were a Jewish committee organized itself into a sort of like a council, like you've got a town hall here and a council presiding over the internal affairs of an area. We had in the ghetto a Jewish council. There was also a police, Jewish police was formed, who was given uniforms, and they were all men liable for army service. They were trained by the army, but the Germans employed them as a police. They had to swear some kind of allegiance to the Germans, and they kept the order inside the ghetto. The council tried and negotiate with the Germans for food deliveries and all kinds of services that were important. But as time went, it got more and more difficult. The Germans weren't interested. And while all this was going on, that's already toward the end of 1940, I think. I'm not very good on dates, so don't forget I was only about 9-10 years old, and I can't, as it comes later, I remember much better. But what happened then was that we had raids. The Germans used to come, close one street from one end to the other. Like, for instance, here you've got Oxford Street. They would block completely all the
streets
to it and all the outlets, and come with big lorries, go into the buildings and call everybody down, check the papers for, it was laughable because it didn't really matter who or what. And so many people went to the left, the other lot went to the right. They made two groups out of all the residents. And while this was going on down, they had another lot of, and they mostly had a sort of at the time the SS was dealing with these raids, the SS branch of German army. And they used to go around the flats and check that nobody is left behind, all those cellars. And so there was very, very difficult to hide before that selection when it came. And that happened almost every week. And every week there was a few thousand people, I would say, sometimes a few hundred, but other times more. Sometimes they closed two streets as well, and they had more lorries and more trains available. I don't know. We didn't really realize what was going on for the first few months at all. And people used to say, oh, I had a postcard from so-and-so. But I don't know how they arranged it, but they were all sort of not true, these postcards. Whatever it was just to, subdue the alarm, as it were. And one day, and that was already sort of, we were in the ghetto, my father turned up, which was absolutely amazing. Or was it just before the wall was completed? I think it was before the wall was completed. He came back already from the, that was in winter of 1940. I don't know whether it was February or March. It was still, the river was frozen, so it must have been February. He and a party of four other people with some guides went at night through the forest near the River Bug, the same river that we were on holiday in summer. And I think three of the party got killed, were shot at, and he had to make his own way through the forest, and I don't know how, but he came back into Warsaw in spite of what my mother was writing to him. And he was in a very bad state because he had frozen feet from the walk that he had to take. I think he did get some lifts from peasants and so on, but not most of the way he had to walk. And he joined us in Warsaw just before the ghetto was closed, it was. And also, at the very beginning, I forgot to mention, we were told, just in the ghetto, before it was closed, the first thing they did was to make us wear armbands. They were white armbands with a blue Star of David on it. And children from the age of, I think it was 10. I know that I had to wear one already. My sister not, she was younger. So all of us were wearing these armbands. But when we went across sometimes, when we were allowed to go to the Polish side later, we had to take the armbands immediately after we left the wall, and then put it back when we entered the ghetto. And all the men, the Germans used to walk on the streets and made the men take their hats off to them, and all sorts of sort of really bestial behavior, you know. Now, after the actual ghetto was emptied of quite a lot of people, the Germans decided that they're going to employ us all. We mustn't work as before, even the people who were professional, except for doctors. Doctors and dentists, I think, that doctors especially, they kept to the last minute because they were terrified of typhoid, and there was a fantastic epidemic of typhoid going on. There were people dying on the streets, beggars and so on, because the food situation got worse as time went on. Deliveries were hardly any to the ghetto. And sometimes, you know, the Poles managed to get some potato sacks or whatever through the sewers, but to help the people there, but very seldom. Because if the Germans caught anybody helping, they would shoot them. So nobody wanted to risk their life, really, because of that. And my father was fully employed the moment he recovered from his frozen bites and all sorts of wounds that he got through the walk. And the Germans decided to divide the ghetto into three workshops. By then, the ghetto wasn't as big because a lot of people were taken away. And this is the end of 40, I think, coming on to 41, where there were three workshops created. One was called Schultz, which was making uniforms for the German army. There were machines and big, you know, cutting experts, and the Germans supplied the material, and all the people, even children from 11 years old, had to be employed. The other workshop was called Tebens, and they were making also some kind of, I'm not sure what it was, for the army. And the third one was called the Brush Workshop, which we were making, that the one that we were. My father was in they made a sort of like a first aid clinic. Each of those workshops had its own sort of clinic. And each of the workshops consisted of about two streets only. Let's say Oxford Street and Regent Street. That's it. And each flat, each house in these areas had, very difficult to say, but some of them had about 50 flats on average. And the flats were about three, four rooms, kitchen and bathroom. And two families, sometimes six people, would have to fit into this. In other words, we had to share the flat with another family and walked through each other's bedrooms and things like that. We were quite cramped. But now, the old people and the very young people were not employed by the Germans. In other words, my grandfather would not be employed in any of the workshops, and my sister was too young. I was all right. I could make these brushes. And the brushes were a sort of great, I don't know, they must have used them in concentration camps or in labor camps. I don't know where they used those. They're sort of a great big broom, not a brush, but a broom, were given a sort of a wooden piece of, a piece of wood about 1 inch thick, all perforated by about 4 inches, 3 inches wide, and perforated with small holes. And then we were given a stump with wire, and we had, and also a lot of like very thin cuttings of wood, which were soaked in some kind of liquid that made them more pliable. And we were supposed to make a loop through the hole with a wire, put those a bundle of these stems that were soaked into, and through the half of it, pull the wire back so it fitted into the hole of the wood. And one after another, the wire sort of went in and out. And a broom like that had a large sort of hole in the middle where the handle was fitted. And we were working from about 8 in the morning until 6 in the evening, with a very, very short break for a sandwich or something. We had to bring our own as well. And those brushes were sort of put, you know, in a tower next to you. And at the end of the day, they counted how many you made. If you didn't make enough, then the next day you were punished for it in some way or another.